former ourselves? Are we true to former commitments? Sometimes you make a lot of commitments and then the world takes them away from you, and that's natural. You have to learn how to recalibrate. A lot of people fall, and the really successful people are not the ones who don't fall, but will get back up and reassess and reestablish vision and reestablish idealism. We talked about last week, those who hear Parshas Korach, where do we stand on the sarcastic, cynical scale? Do we look at things and accept them, or do we always try to find the negative? And we're smart enough to always find the flaw in the system or the flaw in the person. So these are a couple, five or six Parshas during the year that it's good to listen to these shiurim and similar shiurim and think about, how am I doing in this respect? So Parshas Chukas talks about a lot of different topics. For those of you who aren't keeping score, there's a 40-year or 38-year transition between Korach and Chukas. Korach occurs in the second year. Chukas occurs in the 40th year. You haven't noticed, but we're already a totally different generation. And Moshe Rabbeinu feels the need to deliver new messages that the previous generation may not have learned. So there are a lot of coded references to the importance of Torah. A lot of coded references. So we'll take a look at some of those references tonight. One reference is found in a very interesting set of psukim. It doesn't really talk about Torah, but it's related to Torah, and it's supremely, supremely important that everyone understand this message, especially the boys in this room. You probably need this message more than others. One sheet, I think. In the end of Sefer Chukah, Parshas Chukas, there's a strange story, a strange interlude about wars fought between Moab and Amori. Sichon Melech Amori is the great conqueror of his day, and he acquires and conquers vast, vast tracts of land from Moab, who lost these major battles to Amori. Now, these battles have to be recorded. What do we care whether Amori beat Moab or Moab beat Amori? Why are these battles relevant to us? Well, they're relevant for a very important reason. Why? Does anyone know? What happens if Moab wins these vast tracts of land, in this case, defends her turf, and retains sovereignty over these vast tracts of land on the current east bank of the Jordan River? Then those lands are untouchable to the Jewish people. Because Al Tatsaris Moab, we're not allowed to go to battle with Moab. We're not allowed to conquer Moab. Moab comes from Lot. Moab off limits. But Baruch Hashem, for the sake of Jewish conquest, these lands were filtered from Moab to Sichon Melech Amori. Once Sichon owns these lands, and we ultimately battle Sichon, as we'll read about in Parshas Balak and Pinchas and all the other battles, then of course we take the lands, and then in the end of Sefer Bamidbar, 2.5 Shvatim decide to settle these lands. Reuven, God, and the Chasi Shevet Menashe. So the outcome of these wars are very, very faithful for the map of Eretz Yisrael. If Moab retains these lands, they cannot and will not be conquered. If Amori conquers these lands, as they do, then one day they can be Jewish-held lands. Really faithful wars. However, it's not that the battles are recorded, it's how they're recorded. And here's where the satire sets in, and since it's a satire, there's a hidden message. Listen to these psukim in Perek Chav Aleph, Pasuk Chav Zayin. We'll start with Chav Aleph Chav Zayin. It's the top of the page. These are psukim that we'll read in a different context, in Mirtz Hashem, towards the end of Shir. But listen to how these battles are described. Al Kein Yamru HaMoshlim Bo Cheshbon. The people who speak about parables, wars were always sung about by bards and poets, parable speakers. Homer spoke about the great wars. Beowulf, the great wars of old, the great legends of yore. Al Kein Yamru HaMoshlim Bo Cheshbon. It's a play on words. The people who spin parables, who spin songs of war, as well as the rulers, the Moshlim. They're all descending on Cheshbon. Cheshbon is the center. Cheshbon is the Waterloo. Cheshbon is the D-Day, D-Day Normandy. Cheshbon is where the big battle will take place. The leaders, the kings, the generals, the diplomats, the politicians, the poets, the correspondents, CNN. Everyone's descending on Cheshbon, the major metropolis of Moab. This will one day be known as a great city of Sichon because it was conquered by Sichon. Because a fire emitted from Cheshbon. Lehavam mikiryas Sichon. A flame leaped out from Sichon, the cities of Sichon. Achla Armov. Actually, Cheshbon wasn't a Moabite city. Cheshbon was a Sichon city, and that's where all the garrisons started to gather, and all the soldiers, and this fire leapt out of Sichon and consumed all the cities of Moab. Achla Armov. It consumed, it burned all the cities of Moab. Baale Bamos Arnon. The people who lived on high cliffs or highland of Arnon. Oy lecha Moav, woe is to you, Moav. Avadata am Kemosh, you have forfeited the people of Kemosh, you lost the people of Kemosh to Sichon. Nasan banav pleitin, the people of Kemosh, their children are now refugees because their parents have been killed in battle. Uvenosav bashvis, and their daughters are in captivity. Lemelech emari Sichon, to the great leader of Sichon. Vaniram avad cheshbon ad divon, you've lost all the lands till divon. Vanashim ad nofach asher ad neva. These psukim, guys, are absolutely preposterous. These were undoubtedly phrases, songs, terms that were sung by Moabite or even Amorite poets and bards about the great conquest of Sichon. Woe is to you, Moab, her poets sung in lament. Your daughters are now in captivity. Your sons are now refugees wandering the earth. You've lost Kemosh. You've lost Arnon. You've lost Divon. You've lost Nofach. What do we care? It's almost as if the Torah is carving out three psukim for the poets of Moab to lament their great loss to Sichon. What do we care? We may need the information, but we certainly don't need such a detailed description of lands. Does anyone know where Nofach is? Does anyone know where Medva is? Does anyone care? These lands were conquered by Sichon, subsequently conquered by Moshe in the great battles we read about. And they were renamed. Medva was probably renamed. Gilad or whatever was renamed. Nofach, Medva, Kemosh, Divon. Not, who cares? We care about the woe and the lamentation. Oy lecha Moav, woe is to you, Moav. Why are these psukim recorded? We talked so often this year about meaningful events that are short-changed, that don't have any description, and seemingly meaningless stories that are given elaborate, painstaking detail, because there's a hidden message. What's the hidden message of describing these wars, not just technically, in short and expeditious fashion, but extensively, in ways that are almost classic in their description of war? So I saw Yonah smiling before, because there's a Gemara about this, and this Gemara functions as the introduction to a very important Musar Sefer. The most famous Musar Sefer, which was written about 100 years before the Musar movement began. The Musar movement began in the mid-1800s, early 1800s, but there was a Sefer by Rebbe in Moshe, Chaim Litzato, the Mesillas Yesharim, written in the beginning of the 18th century, in the beginning of the 1700s, but it was adopted as like the Bible of Musar Sefarim. And in his Sefer, he tries to encourage people not just to let life continue aimlessly, endlessly, but cheshbon nefesh. I told you this. This is what I began the shiur with. You will only be successful in the next 10 years of your life if you have the ability to stop the treadmill, stop the conveyor belt, and say, honestly, where am I succeeding? Where am I failing? And how am I going to address my failures? If you just simply rewrite your aims based on your performance, you'll sink into mediocrity or less. Well, these are my aims, because that's what I'm doing. What were my aims when I left yeshiva? How much did I want to learn? How committed was I to davening? And if I'm not meeting my expectations, how can I change? What has to change in my life? So, the Mesillas Yesharim was a strong proponent of Cheshbon HaNefesh. And he chose these psukim to try to emphasize the importance of Cheshbon HaNefesh. And I'll show you his drasha. It's the Gemara in Bava Basra, Ayin Ches. But beyond stressing the importance of Cheshbon HaNefesh, there's a hidden message here that I want to stress, which Mesillas Yesharim did not stress. So I'll tell you his message, and then I'll tell you my message, which he didn't write about, but to me, in some ways, is even more important than his message. So let's read the Gemara in Bava Basra, source number 5, all the way on the end of the page. Source number 5. Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachman, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, May dechziv, al kein yamru hamoshlim, hamoshlim, this is the Gemara in Bava Basra. These are not leaders. These are not generals. The reference of the pasuk is moshlim b'yitzram, people who are in control of their yitzram, people who dictate behavior rather than just fall into behavior. People who make decisions and stick by them. Moshel b'yitzram. Not leaders, not generals. Moshel b'yitzram. Ba'al cheshbon. Why are these leaders gathering in cheshbon? The people who control their own yitzers, people who author their decisions rather than just being led to decisions involuntarily. Why are they gathering in a city called cheshbon? They're not gathering in a city called Cheshbon. They're gathering to conduct a Cheshbon HaNefesh. And this was in Maseilas Yesharim's derivation. This is what he drew from the Gemara in Bava Basra. The real heroes are the people that are Moshe B'Yitzram, people who control their Yetzaharas. And they're gathering in Cheshbon. They're gathering to conduct, again, for people that are coming a little late, to remind you, 6:15, not 6:30. They're gathering to conduct a Cheshbon HaNefesh. And this is the Maseilas Yesharim's opportunity to stress the importance of the Cheshbon HaNefesh. I remember someone I was very touched by, an older boy that I remember in high school, who told me that he conducted a Cheshbon HaNefesh every night. He sat down there every night, he would write a Cheshbon HaNefesh. What is he doing right? What is he doing wrong? And I tried it for about a month. I found the notebook. I was back in my old house in Brooklyn. I found the notebook as like a seventh grader. I sat there conducting a Cheshbon HaNefesh. I was nice to my brother. I wasn't nice to my brother. I got ketchup from my father. I like everything written down. Then I realized at a certain point it was too intense for me. I can't conduct a written Cheshbon HaNefesh every night. This person did. Unfortunately, he died at a very young age. I was like a malach. I remember being very touched by him. And then he went off I subsequently, on one of my flights this winter, I met his sister. You know, she's now married in her middle ages. And like we were schmoozing on the flight. And it turns out that she was a sister to this person. And I told her about how much of an impact he had on me as a young man. And she was like so excited to hear a story about her brother who's been passed away for about 20, 25 years, but if not more. But she was so excited to hear someone who knew her brother and had been so deeply inspired and touched by her brother. But certainly from time to time, at the end of a semester, now you'll be in college next year, now you finish a semester, you just finish your finals, okay, I got my grades, but those grades are irrelevant. The real grades are how am I doing in the eternal grading system. The grading system is going to count towards my Olam Haba. The grading system is not going to determine whether I get this mark or that mark, this profession or that profession, faster or later, but how am I doing in the Olam Haba scorecard? You have to think about where am I. So this is the Maseilas Yesharim's call to Cheshbon HaNefesh. Akein Yarmur HaMoshlim Bo Cheshbon. People that are in control of their lives, take control of your life. Don't just let social pressures, laziness, weakness, cowardice, those are generally the three things that cause people not to make hard and fast decisions. Social pressure. And sometimes social pressure is very assertive. You know, everyone's doing one thing and you feel drawn to do something. Sometimes not just social pressure in the assertive sense, it's just that no one's really working hard. So you get drawn to this point of not really working hard, just wanting to be partly. And it's not like people are pressuring you to come have a cigarette, come drink, come get drunk. But not everyone's doing average things and you grade yourself on a relative scale. Look around me. Everyone around me is, doing all right. I'm doing the same thing. I'm doing a little more than everyone around me. When you get to Shemayim, you don't grade yourself on a relative curve. And Shemayim HaKadosh Baruch Hu looks at you. You don't think of anyone. You don't see anyone. You don't have the time or the interest to see anyone. You just look at your potential, and you look at your performance, and you're mortified by the gap between the two. And the best thing I can advise people when you leave yeshiva, for as long as possible, continue to grade yourself not based on how people in your new environments are performing, but how people in your old environments are performing. The more relationships you have back in yeshiva, because in your new environment, no one's learning Torah. So if I learn 15 minutes a day, I'm a big tzaddik. If I come to minyan 15 minutes a day, I'm a big tzaddik. All of a sudden, you continue to grade yourself based on what people in yeshiva, friends of yours, they're learning 12 hours a day. Where do I stand? Okay, I'm learning maybe an hour a day. I have a lot to catch up, but I just have to be satisfied because that's all I can hammer out given my current environment. So the more relationships you have with friends here, not just Rebbeim, the more you say, my friend who I sat right next to last year is going to Minyan every day, is learning 12 hours a day, is working hard, is joining the army, so I better make sure that where I am, I'm trying my hardest to bump up my performance to 3 hours or 4 hours. I can't reach 12, but at least make sure I go to Minyan and learn 2-3 hours a day. Then you'll know you'll be on safer ground. But the message that I wanted to give you is as follows, and it's very different from the Maseilas Yesharim's message, so it's not just the nuance difference, it's a really important difference, and it's the gap between the text and the drasha. If you're reading the text says, the text speaks about leaders, diplomats, politicians, generals, wars, negotiations, politics, decision-making. Okay, Yomru HaMoshim, Bo Cheshbon, the leaders are coming to Cheshbon. And what are the leaders dealing with in Cheshbon? Wars, battles, decisions, covenants, treaties, who's going to win, who's going to surrender, where will the lines be drawn, who's the armistice? Comes along Shmuel in Bava Basra, Amar of Shmuel Bar Nachman, he says, that's what the texts suggest. But if that were the real message of the Torah, there'd be no warrant for its inclusion, because it's totally irrelevant to the Torah. What's really relevant is the subtext. What's the subtext? Not politicians, not generals, not presidents, not politics, not governments, but one thing. Moral energy. People who may not be in headlines, who may not be discussing so-called exciting events such as wars and politics, but people who are controlling their own lives, Moshlim B'Yitzram, they're gathering not in some big city named Cheshbon, which maybe those days was really important, but today who even knows where Cheshbon is. But they're gathering and conducting eternal Cheshbon on Nefesh, continue the Gemara. Bo Cheshbon, source number 2, Bo Vina, source number 5, line 2, last source. Bo Vina Chashev Cheshbon Shel Olam. Let's think about the real calculus of our world. Not the politics, not the decisions, not the finances. Cheshbon Shel Olam, eternal decisions, eternal evaluations. Hefzen Mitzvah Keneged Schara. What do I gain from a mitzvah, even though it may take some sacrifice? It's a hefset to every mitzvah. Every mitzvah is going to entail a sacrifice. Every time you sit down to learn, those around you are having a better time, are having more fun, are going out, or are having a getting together with friends. And you're sitting in your room, or you're sitting down in the base medrash, and you're encountering eternity. So the schar is greater than the hefset. Schar avera, line number 3, Kenegad Hefseda. Every avera gives you a schar. You enjoy it. Physically, psychologically, it's fun, it's titillating, it's enjoyable, it makes your pace quicken. But there's a hefset aver. So much of mitzvahs and averos is learning how to properly assess eternity and transience. Every avera delivers excitement in an ephemeral sense, and it takes away your eternity. And every mitzvah ignores that excitement in a temporary sense, but gives you eternity. And are you capable of making those cheshbonos? And if you are, the Gemara continues, Tibo Nevesikonein. Im Atal Sekein, if you follow this recipe, Tibo Nevesikonein Be'olam Hazeh, V'tikonein Le'olam Haba. Namely, and here, please, everyone listen, I wish you could, if there's one message you could take from this room, be this message. The world is not driven by politics, war, headlines, governors, presidents, and clubs. The world is driven by moral energy, by mitzvos, averos, and everything that stems from moral activity. Not just in a visionary sense, but in a real sense. You can't legislate reality. Reality is driven by people who make moral decisions, courageous decisions, raise families based on values, build communities. You see what happens when you try to superimpose legislation and politics and government structures on reality. And you see how the Arab world around us, where reality is stronger than whatever governmental structures are trying to be superimposed, that will come and go. And when you're younger, you don't see this, because the headlines are not about moral energy, because that's boring and that's personal, but about this president, and this summit, and this UN, and this peacekeeping force, and this decision, and this army, and that general, and you think that's where reality lies. You think that's where real existence lies. That's the real world, because that seems to be shaping our world. But in larger swaths of time, they're not shaping. Who knows where Cheshbon is? In a million years, who will know where Moscow is? Who knows where Constantinople is? Who cares? These are major centers. Who knows where Alexandria is? These are major centers of ancient civilization. They've come and gone. They've passed. They've faded. What remains? Values. Moral decisions. Moshlim B'Yitzram. And certainly from a Torah perspective, Talmud Torah. Mitzvos. Your relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, when this grand facade fades. What will you take with you to the next world? Not the politics, not the decisions, not the wars, not the military victories. The Torah, the mitzvos. And you have to be able to see through it, but not reject it or negate it, but just simply basically be able to rank it. I just got a Facebook message from a Gush Alam who said, what does Yeshiva think of all the local politics and political changes in Eretz Yisrael? My basic response was, that's not really what we do here in Yeshiva. Remember at the Tisha told you that. We're interested in it. We want to be part of it. Certainly, it's not just politics, but military intervention and serving in the army and protecting our people. We don't just escape to some world of fantasy and ignore the world of reality. But for so many people, there's a displacement where you think that that world, that's really the headlines. Let's see what's really happening in our world. Let me look at the headlines of the newspaper. The headlines are online. That's what's really shaping. It's not shaping. These are temporary adjustments that shift in the sands of time and get reshifted and redrawn and rebuilt. So obviously you can't ignore them. You have to participate. And some chanalanes. But you have to say it's meaningless and therefore we won't join the army, won't be involved in politics, we won't send messengers, we won't send diplomats, we won't be involved in the process. Chas v'shalom. But don't deify them. Don't attribute to them greater weight. As I keep telling you, if President Obama, I'm saying this for an American, but everyone else in the room can fit in their own personalities, walked into a room side by side with Rav Lichtenstein, who would you run to first to shake his hand? If your answer is constantly Rav Lichtenstein, the Rebbe, then you realize, and not just because you have a mitzvah, because you realize that one is actually shaping reality and one is just participating in assisting and enabling reality to be shaped. I truly believe that Rav Lichtenstein has affected the world more than President Obama. Yes. And not just Rav Lichtenstein. Because those are deeper impacts. And this is meant to no disrespect to President Obama, to Bibi Netanyahu. Those are not the people who are really shaping our reality. At all levels. Certainly in the day-to-day reality, for sure. And even in the larger global cosmic reality. The larger political shifts constantly get redrawn, constantly get redone. We had a staff Shabbaton. This past Shabbos, the entire staff of the yeshiva went to a hotel in Yerushalayim just for a weekend to be together, as we would say, talk shop, be together, learn together. We have it every couple of years just to recharge our own batteries and professional getaway, so to speak. So we had, near the hotel, we took a little tiyul. It was boiling hot in Shabbos. We just wanted to take a little tiyul together. It was led by our Yitzchak Levy, of course. And we got to this big monument right near the hotel we were staying. That monument marked the surrender of the Turkish armies to the 17th British, to the 60th British Division, I think, Naftali, on June something, 1917. No, it was December something, 1917, the first night of Hanukkah. And there was a book written in which Rav Yitzchak Levy was sharing with us how everyone across the earth thought this was a major, major event, the first time that the city of Jerusalem had been liberated from Muslim rule, Turkish rule, in a couple hundred years, and they saw this as a messianic sign. Now, the fact that Christians saw this as a messianic sign is understandable, because it was the British battalions that had liberated Jerusalem. That's where they surrendered to the British general. But Jews saw it this way. Jews really saw this. They called it Yom HaGeulah. It was the first night of Hanukkah. All the children named that year were called Geulah, or Yigal. The boys were named Yigal, and the girls were named Geulah. They said there should be a day off, they should say Hallel, but it was the first day of Hanukkah anyway. They saw this, the British were coming back to Yerushalayim, this was a messianic sign that things were moving ahead. Now, it certainly was in retrospect, but not that the British were such great agents of redemption. Those same British forces, which in 1917 people saw as redemptive forces that would help the Jews resettle the land, and certainly in 1917 Jews were allowed to move to Palestine freely, in 20, 30 years would be repressive forces, forces that we had to battle, forces that we had to kick out of the land of Israel in order to advance. Now you could say that in a divine sense, that's part of redemption, because Hashem knew that they would turn sour and that we kicked them out, whatever. So ultimately, this was a regression of redemption. The fact that it could have been that if the Turks would have stayed in Eretz Yisrael, we could have sent more Jews to Palestine. But now that the British came, they prohibited Jews from coming. Who knows if it would have been better in the grander scheme of the Turks? Obviously, it's impossible to calculate. But the real gula comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the real gula comes from our ability to initiate or to solicit HaKadosh Baruch Hu's intervention by our Meisen Tovim, by our Torah, by our mitzvahs, by our moral decisions. So it's so difficult for people that are involved in the world around them, that do participate in politics, that do participate in serving in the army, that do participate in geopolitical dynamics. to be part of it, but not to get lost in this herd mentality, this frenzy, that this is really what's dictating our future. You have to participate in it because these are tools. And there are multiple tools that you try to author redemption with. But more important than whatever political involvement is, are you studying Torah? Are you performing mitzvah? So my message to you is, if I meet you walking down the street in 20 years, and I ask you, what are you doing for Am Yisrael? And you say, I'm a politician, I'm a military general, I'm part of this club, I'm part of, I see you in 5 years on a college campus, and part of this club, part of that club, and you're politically engaged. It depends upon what you answer my next question. If you can answer question B, then answer A is legit. If you can't answer question B, then answer A is fraudulent. My next question is, yeah, but tell me, are you learning? Are you going to Minyan? Are you keeping mitzvahs? Are you passionate about Avodas Hashem in the narrow ritual sense? If your answer is yes, and in addition, this is my contribution, and in addition to the extra hour of learning, I'm taking the extra hour being politically involved, taking the extra hour, but I truly realize that without answer B, answer A is empty. That's perfect. That's your decision. But if answer B is missing, and saying, well, you know, it's really about politics and really about, activism, because what does it really help if I learn, if I keep Torah and mitzvahs? And answer B is fraudulent, and the Torah is making fun of you. Are you listening to me? This is a satire about you. Next time someone asks you on the street, stops you and says, what's the best satire in the entire Torah? Literarily, this is the best satire. I've read a lot of good satires. Oh, Cain, that's why the psukim are so funny. Yo, Ramoshin, Bo Cheshbon, woe is to you, the people of Moab. Anytime you have text that's satiric, it's because there's a subtext that's literal. And the satire is a way to draw your attention. This is something special. But what's the real message? Shmuel Bar Nachman gives the real message. Al-Kain Yom Ramoshin, you think that those generals and politicians really shaped the future map and topography? Nothing and no impact. Who knows where Cheshbon is? Who knows where Kemosh is? Who knows where Nofach is? Who knows where who cares? The people that are Moshe and Yitzron, oh, they really have ripple effects on generations and generations of people. You want to do something great in this world? Be a Talmud Chacham. Give your grandchildren a grandfather who's a Talmud Chacham. That will have ripple effects. And your grandchildren will have a grandfather who's a Talmud Chacham. And then maybe they'll have grandchildren who are Talmidei Chachamim. And then you'll affect hundreds and hundreds of people in deep, deep, existentially shaping and formative ways. Then you'll be a Moshe. You may not be recorded in history books, but trust me, history books will fade. You may not grab attention in headlines, but they'll fade. Again, don't take this as anti-politics and anti-headlines. It's just making sure you maintain your equilibrium, your balance, that you're part of it. I know many, many people that are headline makers. And the ones I truly respect are the ones that after they're finished making the headlines, they go home at night and they learn, they go to Minyan, they do mitzvahs, and in addition, they know what the really important part of their lives are. The Torah and the mitzvahs and the davening. But Hashem gave them opportunity. Hashem gave them talent. Hashem gave them resources. So they're going out and making headlines. But they know that if they get one more headline, one less headline, it's not going to make a difference as to who they are as a person and what their success level is. Whereas those who feel that their ability to affect the world is how many headlines they're going to make and the rest of their lives is deficient, those are the people that the Torah is laughing at. You think you're affecting the world. You may be contributing, but you're not really a Moshe. You're an Eved. You're being dragged along by systems. If you're really emotional, it starts at the baseline. The baseline, Torah, mitzvahs, tefillah, avodas Hashem. On top of that, you feel you can have an impact? No one is going to tell you not to have an impact, but just make sure the baseline is there. And that's why this is such a wonderful, wonderful satire. Because the text is totally ridiculous, and it draws attention to its absolute stupidity. It has no meaning, because it's drawing your attention that those who are involved in the text are being laughed at. Those who are being involved in the subtext as well as the text, and those are people we celebrate. Getting back to the psukim in the beginning of Parshas Chukas about Talmud Torah proper, so let's read some psukim and then we'll see what Chazal had to say about that. Okay? The primary psukim, which talk about Torah again, everything in a coded fashion, is in the Shira. This is the second Shira of the Torah. The first Shira was Shira Sayam. This is the Shira which the next generation, 40 years, 38 years later, recites. The context is seeing the Be'er, provide water. Chazal write in additional narrative, but the Be'er wasn't just watery that day, but the Be'er was very bloody, and it was the blood of the Amorites who wanted to ambush the Jewish people on the hills above the pass through which the Jews walked, and Hashem made a nace, and the two mountains crushed into one another to prevent them from ambushing the Jews, and their bones got crushed, and their blood flowed into the valley beneath, and the Jews were able to see that they were saved, even though they weren't aware that they were even being threatened or imperiled by the Amorim. So they said Shira Tashem. And in the middle of the Shira, source number one, or not even one, it's not labeled, but source number one, Perek Chaf Aleph Pasuk Yudches, Be'er Chafaru Asarim, it's a well which was dug by great people. Karua Nedive Am, it was shoveled by great generous people who subjected their lives to the national ark. And of course, Chazal see these Sarim, these Nedive Am, as a veiled reference to Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, Miriam. These were the real Sarim, the real leaders, the real Nedive Am. This was Miriam, we had to be heir all those years. B'mechokek b'mishan olsam. And here's where the language becomes very hieroglyphic. Source number one, line two. Umi midbar matana. From the desert, it was given as a gift. Umi matana nachliel. And the gift became a river of God, Nachliel. Umi Nachliel Bamos. And the river of God became a cliff, or became a plateau. These words, the gift of the desert. What's the gift of the desert? Torah. The gift of the desert becomes a river of God. What is Torah compared to so often? Which liquid is Torah compared to? Mayim. Ein Mayim al Torah. River of God is Torah. Not just the river of God, Nachliel, but also you're learning Yesh Nochalim now. We inherit God. How do we inherit God? By learning His Torah. How do we inherit HaKadosh Baruch Hu? By studying His Torah. By studying His Torah, Bamos, we become a better person, a higher person. So Chazal saw these psukim as a reference to Talmud Torah. I mean, Midbar, Matana, the gift of the desert. I mean, Matana, the gift, Nachliel, a river of Hashem, inheriting Hashem. I mean, Nachliel, Bamos. So Chazal had certain drashas, and I want to read through some of those drashas with you. Source number two, we'll start with drasha number two. I don't know if we'll get back to one. We'll certainly start with drasha number two. Drasha number two. Actually, we'll start with drasha number one from Erevin. Magdich Siv, Midbar Matana, Matana Nachliel, Minachliel Bamos, and Yibamos Agai, it's a Gemara in Erevin. Amar Le, Im Adam Mesin Atzma Kamid Barze, Shachkol Dashim Bom, Tara Nitin Alab Matana. What is one of the ways to acquire Torah? Humility. Anivus. A person who's arrogant can learn a lot of Torah knowledge, but will very rarely internalize Torah wisdom. Very rarely internalize Torah. For two reasons. First of all, because every Torah learning is part Siyata Dishmaya. No matter how hard you try to learn Torah, at both levels, both in terms of understanding Torah as well as finding the time to learn Torah. Sometimes people ask me, Rebbe, I'm leaving yeshiva. What's the best thing I can do to make sure that I learn Torah properly when I'm not yeshiva? The answer I give them is, have kavana during Berachas Ahava Sol. And during Berachas Ahava Rabba, you're asking HaKadosh Baruch Hu for help in studying Torah, for help in understanding Torah, for help in wanting to learn Torah, v'sein b'libeinu, Lilmod Lame Lishmor Lasos and Lakainis told every Salmatar Sech, I promise you that if you have Kavanah during that bracha, you'll probably learn a lot of Torah. Because you'll really want it, and your Kavanah during that bracha will make you realize how much you want it or need it. If you just blow by that bracha, then Torah isn't really important to you. You're not having Kavanah during that bracha. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu will respond to people that are morally fit, people that are humble, people that are modest, people that are arrogant, people that are self-serving, people that are egotistical. Hashem won't help. Hashem won't give Siyata Dishmaya. But it's not just that if you're humble, Hashem will help you learn Torah. If you're humble, then you'll contain Torah. I remember I've told you this many times. Rav Lichtenstein told me, and this is important beyond the trait of humility. Rav Lichtenstein used to tell us that if you don't understand the Tosfos, or you don't remember a Gemara you learned, that's not an intellectual limitation, that's a moral flaw. Because if I ask you the score of the game from 3 weeks ago, whatever team, whatever sport you like, whatever sport your team played in, you probably remember the score. But if I asked you the Tosfos you learned 3 weeks ago, you don't. So how come you remember the score of the game, you don't remember Tosfos? Because the score of the game is important to you. You feel passionate about it. You just felt passionate about Tosfos. If you saw every Tosfos as Devar Hashem, then of course you'd make it your business to remember every Tosfos, try to understand every Tosfos. Fast your birthday, remember your birthday. Generally, remember things that are important to you. So remembering, retention is not just an intellectual aptitude, it's also a moral decision. What I feel is important enough to remember. What I feel is just not important enough. One day you'll be in medical school, some of you. You'll be in law school. You'll be in graduate school. And if you're able to trace whatever you're studying to your profession, I'm going to need this information every day in my life as a doctor, every day in my life as a lawyer, every day in my life, every day in my career as a businessman, every day in my career as a computer technician. So you're going to really work hard at internalizing that information. If you were to tell yourself, I'm going to need this bit of Torah every day of life for my eternity, I mean, you have to remind me, in 10 million years, those who understand Yakir will be, you know, involved in the conversation in Shemayim. Those who don't understand Yakir will be sitting on the side, you know, blindfold. They won't have any part of the conversation. For the next 10 billion years, the Torah I'm going to learn tomorrow is going to be supremely important for my discourse, for my interaction. So you try your hardest to know whatever you can, to understand whatever you can, to remember whatever you can, so that one day you can speak intelligently about Yakir. In Shemayim, intelligently about Nachla, intelligently about Yerusha, intelligently about Mishmash. So part of Torah learning is not just how smart you are, but how much you see it as Hashem. If you're a humble person, then you see more of Hashem. If you're an egotistical person, you see a little more of yourself. You don't see that much of Hashem, then you're not going to learn that much stuff. It's a beautiful Gemara in Timura that Yoshua comes to visit Moshe right as Moshe is about to die. And Moshe turns to Yoshua, who is famous for his humility. And he says, Yoshua, do you have any questions? I'm dying. Do you have any questions to ask me before I leave this world? Ask away. This is your last chance. And Yoshua, who is famous for his humility, for his modesty, he walked around and his name was Hoshea. He didn't even want to go by the word Yoshua because that was too highfalutin the name. He asked people, please call me Hoshea. Don't call me Yoshua. The Pasuk in Hazino that calls him Hoshea. Hazal Darshan, he pleaded with people, call me Hoshea. Part of what makes Rav Lichtenstein so unique is he does it one title. I remember the first time, my first day as a Rebbe, I don't know if I ever told you this story, my first day as a Rebbe, I've been planning this day for years, learning, going for smicha. This is my first day as a Rebbe, it was 1995, sat down, we were learning Kiddushin, sat in the base medrash, rolled up my sleeves, here I am, first day as a Rebbe, someone comes over to me, it was Rabbi Carol's year, you can ask, I don't know who it was, comes over to me, Rabbi Tarigan, I have a question for you. Oh, great. Sit down, please. I've been waiting for this. I'm all ready. I've been trained as a Rebbe. Sit down. What would you like to ask? So he says, does the Rebbe think that it's wise to make this decision? Does the Rebbe think you're referring to me in third person? Are you kidding me? I got up, took this guy by the neck, and was about to kill him. If you ever refer to me in third person again... Let me tell you what I'm going to do to the Rebbe. You! Do you think? I wasn't trained to see myself in third person, rabbi, you know. The hardest thing becoming a rabbi is you have to be called rabbi. And I wish that I didn't have to have that title because it can lead to inflation of self. It can lead to trying to see yourself through lenses other than who you are. I sometimes laugh, and I don't mean any insult to anyone's father or to anyone's future here. I sometimes laugh when I see a sign on a door, Robert G. Jew, whatever, I'm speaking a name not to insult anyone, Robert G. Jew, Esquire. Why would anyone want to take a title? You know, a doctor needs a title. Because if you're in the hospital, you have to know who's a doctor and who's a janitor, who's a doctor and who's a nurse, because hopefully the doctor will come for the surgery, not the nurse. So you can't come and say, Jim, come to surgery, because a lot of Jims will come. You have to say, Dr. Smith, come to surgery. So in that field, you need titles. In the rabbinic field, you need titles because part of the role of a Rebbe, as best as you can, is to give you a Kavanah Torah and Kavanah Kodesh Baruch Hu and the Mara Rabbah. So you have to call them Rabbi in order to give yourself that sense you're being Mechabe Son as being Mechabe Torah. But why would anyone who's operating in a field in which you don't need titles want to take a title? It's only one reason, because they want extra cover. But they don't realize that the title is a trap. Because at a certain point, the kavod becomes so overwhelming that you stop seeing yourself as a human being and you start seeing yourself as a professional rather than a human being. And to a lot of guys here, and I sense this because 25 years ago, 30 years ago, the hot profession for Jews was become a doctor. Today it's changing. In a lot of areas, the medical field is changing very rapidly. And Baruch Hashem, at least today, this could change by the time you enter the workforce. A lot of you will enter the corporate world. finance, investments, banking, companies, engineering, computers, work for big companies. This is, in my mind, one of the biggest dangers of the corporate world. Because you'll probably be very talented, and the corporate world will come chasing you. And the corporate world, by definition, gives a lot of honor, gives a lot of respect, gives a lot of... And you start to lose sense of whom you are as a person. You start to lose sense. One of the things I like about living in Eretz Yisrael is that that element isn't as important. Right? Generally, you'll find that when you talk to people in Chutz La'aretz, one of the questions you ask them, or one of the questions you ask, first off, is, what do you do? Hi, my name is so-and-so, what do you do? Eretz Yisrael is not really one of the top three, four questions, because money and high salaries really aren't attached to most positions. Most positions that people have here are not significantly greater earning positions than others. And when you sit in shul, the plumber probably is earning a lot more money than the doctor. Which means that asking someone what he does is not really, you know, where do you live, how many children do you have, where are you from, you know, especially when you speak to people in Made Aliyah. And it allows people to escape the trap of titles. And very often when people, and my recommendation to you is, if you do enter the corporate world as lawyers, try to be part of the corporate world without getting ensnared in this whole corporate culture of titles and feeling important. You know, you're walking your first day, you're a little pisher out of law school, you have three secretaries who are willing to do anything you need to enhance your efficiency. Go get donuts, go sharpen my pencils, go call a cab. And I understand that you need to have secretaries to do, so to speak, less important work to the company, because if you hailed your own cab and sharpened your own pencils and prepared your own lunch, your boss would be upset. I'm not paying you $250,000 a year to sharpen pencils. I'm paying you $250,000 a year to go over legal briefs. And these are jobs that I want someone to do who I'm paying far less. So you don't have the right to go sharpen your own pencils and hail your own cab and clean your own desk and vacuum your own floor, whatever. But you can become so accustomed to having people serve you that you walk away with an inflated sense of self, that you're more than just an average person. And that comes to the fore when you're in shul, when you're in a community, and you're just meant to deal with people on an equal footing, and all of a sudden you start treating people as less than you and inferior to you because they don't have the same title, they don't earn as much, they don't have the same amount of secretaries or assistants serving them. And to me, I know the difference. I know certain people that are in the corporate world, and when I speak to them outside of the corporate context, I feel like they're looking down on me. Maybe they're not me because I'm a rabbi, though some people are me as well, but I just hear the way they talk to others, and I find it very, very distasteful. Then I see some people who have a lot of respect for, who are part of that world, but when they leave that world, they're just normal people. They don't feel holier than thou. They don't feel better than others. They don't talk to others in a demeaning and condescending fashion. So Torah was given in a midbar, because if you really want to acquire Torah, try to be a humble person. Try to be a modest person. I promise you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will give you more Torah. And a lot of you are going to accomplish a lot in this world, and a lot of you are going to accomplish a lot in the next couple of years, and which guys are known to take leadership positions, running the Bnei Akiva, and running the learning, and being the Gabbai. And I'm pushing you to achieve. Part of the best thing you could do is take communal positions. Be in charge of the scholarship and the learning in your college campus, and be involved. Like I told you, I spent a lot of time the last couple of weeks trying to connect with alumni who were in various different places and colleges, and I just got an email from an alumni. He said he was the Gabbai in his college, and he was the head of the Adult Education Committee, and now there are other people who want to take those positions. He doesn't have a communal role. And I encourage you to have communal roles, because that will anchor you. Anchor you as part of a Jewish community. Anchor you as part of Minyan. To take those roles. But don't all of a sudden become too big for yourself, and don't become inflated, and don't become egotistical. As much as you accomplish, try to make sure that you are an average, regular Joe who's able to talk and interact with everyone around you on equal footing, not holier than thou, not better than anyone. And I promise you, that'll help your Talmud Torah. And that's Chazal's message in Erevin, Daf Nun Dalit, Umi Midbar Matana. Why was Torah given in a desert? Because if you really want to acquire Torah, read it again, line number 2, source 2. Im adam meisim atzmo kamid barzev, a person becomes like a desert, chakol dashimbo. Don't take it literally. When Chazal wrote this 2,000 years ago, 1,800 years ago, when they said this, they talked about becoming a midbar that people step on. They didn't live in the same world of abuse and exploitation that we live in. Unfortunately, if you say those words today, you become someone that people step on. Chas v'shalom, those connotations can become very dark, because unfortunately our world has so much pressure, so much torture, so much darkness, so much tension that people are taking it out on other people, verbally, physically, sexually, all sorts of abuse. And this is something that we have to start wrestling with as a community, unfortunately. And this is one of the challenges you're all going to have, to learn how to be agents of redressing some of these situations in a responsible fashion. I've talked to you about this before. Don't just go blow the whistle irresponsibly the second you send someone that's doing something inappropriate, all of a sudden shoot from the hip and ruin people's career. There are responsible ways to do it, but you have to do something. You can't just assume, oh, there's abuse, let it lie, let's sweep it under the carpet. And certainly, if you are, chas v'shalom, either an abuser or a victim of abuse, if you're an abuser, then go seek help. It doesn't mean you're a bad person, it just means you have a bad trait. You have to find people that will help you break those cycles. These are cycles, and sometimes cycles of behavior become very, very hard. And if you're a victim of abuse, you should not rationalize, well, I deserve it, well, I'm not that. Because generally, abuse is both dished out and received by the absence of self-esteem. People that don't have self-esteem are apt to become, not, you know, it's not like a shoe-in, a slam dunk, abusers, because that's the way you get self-esteem, by putting someone down. Or victims of abuse. When you receive abuse from someone, you say, look, I'm not really that great anyway, so, you know, I'm so fortunate to have that person as my spouse, even though, Chas v'shalom, we do all sorts of stuff. So, person is my friend, even though very, because, you know, who am I? Look at that guy, that person's great. Look at that man, he's great. I'm so privileged to be his wife. And you take all sorts of abuse. And you have to learn that you shouldn't be giving it, nor should you be receiving it. There's no place in our world for taking out your frustrations and tensions and anger on other people in an abusive, chronic, pathological way. You always take out on each other. Obviously, you live with people, your siblings, your spouses, you know, you always release tension and take things out. But in a chronic, exploitative, precalculating, menacing, day to day, day in, day out. Obviously, you have good moods, bad moods. Part of living with people is you bear their frustrations and you allow them to vent on you. But I mean in a really ugly and dark fashion. So Chazal never intended, turn yourself into a welcome mat, let people step on you, you're great, the Chas v'shalom. But in their terminology, they were speaking about humility, they were speaking about modesty, they were speaking about lack of pretense, lack of presumption. So you want to leave yeshiva and have a way to ensure you'll learn more Torah? Make sure you're a humble person. Make sure you don't think too highly of yourself. Feel gifted that Hashem gave you the opportunity to learn in yeshiva, to learn so well. But don't feel holier than other people, and don't let it get to your head. And then the Gemara has a second. The Medrash has a second reason the Torah was given in the desert. Lekach nitna bamidbar. Line number 3 of the Medrash. We'll start from the beginning. Lama nitna bamidbar. Why was it given in a desert? A very famous question. You think Torah should be given in Eretz Yisrael? Torah should be given in Beis HaMikdash? Torah should be given in civilization? All of a sudden, the Midbar, a no-name place, Sinai, who knows where Sinai is, who cares where Sinai is? We don't care where Sinai is. Archaeologists care. Nothing. Our Maria's Kedusha of Sinai is nothing. Why is it given a nondescript mountain? Shilo nitna b'hembaretz, if it was given in Eretz Yisrael, haya shevet shenitna b'tchum armani kodimba. The shevet that Torah was given to would say, oh, Sheva Naftali, we're the real owners of Torah. Our derech, our approach, our style, our dress, this is a way to learn Torah. Either you're Naftali or you're nothing. One of the famous lines that Rav Amital hammered away, I can hear his voice in this room telling us, Ein monopol Torah. There is no monopoly to Torah. Torah was given in a wasteland, uncivilized. Desert is owned by everyone. There is no one derech of Torah. I think Rav Amital once told this, I don't remember as clearly, but if he didn't say it, it's still important. The only derech which isn't the derech is the derech which assumes it's the only derech. It's the only derech which isn't the derech. You've come across a derech which says, this is the only derech of learning, this is the only derech of Avodas Hashem, this is, Baruch Hashem, you're disposed to be in yeshiva. By and large, you chose this yeshiva because by and large, you found this derech was your derech. You met the rabbanim, you did your investigation, your guidance counsel. This is a good place for you. And I hope there's a high level of identification and buy-in. You agree with what's happening. You feel comfortable. These are the rabbanim that taught me. This is the derech I feel comfortable. You feel passionate about it. But don't for a second go back and a kid who learned in a different yeshiva, oh my goodness, he doesn't. This is derech. That's her derech. That's how they get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And a bigger danger, not just that you'll denigrate or dismiss other people's drachim, but you'll find people that can give you input and inspiration, but they're not exactly the rebbeim you met in Yeshiva Har Etzion. They're not as funny as Rav Tarek. No one is. Just set up my own punchlines. Chas v'shalom, they wear a black hat. Oh my goodness. Woe is to the future of mankind. They don't say Hallel on Yom Ha'atzmaut. They don't believe there's any value in secular literature. Different drachim, different hashkafas. Hashem made people differently. Beggars can't be choosers. You want to be a chooser? You want to choose your derech? Come to the land where you can make choices like that. You're in it now. There's a Haredi world here. There's a Hezder world here. A Siddush world here. There's a Ba'ayin world. You can take a choice. Whatever you feel is for you. Oh, you decided not to stay? Okay, it's a legitimate choice. No one is excoriating that decision, chastising that decision. Okay, so go back. But you may be in a city, in most cities, where you may not have to work. In most cases in Chutz Laaretz, as you know, most of the very successful Rabbanim or teaching Torah, in most cases, depends where you are, and to have a Haredish orientation. It may not just be the fault line of Haredi versus Dati, or may there be other issues. Okay, I made a decision. I'm not going to spend the next couple of years learning Torah and Eretz Yisrael. So I can decide which yeshiva to go to, which derech to find. Plenty of Talmidei Chachamim, by definition. I decided to be a Chutz Laaretz. I was like, yeah, I'm a beggar. I can't be a Jew. I have to find whichever Rebbe, you know, I can, and learn Torah and be inspired, whichever Olam, whichever people, whichever B'nai Torah I can find, and be inspired by them and try to hook up with them. At least be a smart beggar. But be an idiot beggar. Door to door, well, you know, that coin is not shiny enough. I don't want it. That dollar bill is a little creased. I'll come back later. You only gave me 10, I'll pass. Don't be an idiot beggar. You're a beggar. I remember a conversation I'll never forget with a student who was going back to a small town in the United States. He said, "What are you going to learn for the summer?" I said, "Well, in the summer in this town, there's only one kollel that's open. It's the Lakewood Kollel. I would never walk in there." Never walk in there? I remember asking the following question. I said, "Let's say, Chas v'shalom, you're a dialysis patient. You're a kidney failure. There's one hospital in town that provided dialysis. But you didn't like the lunch. Or you didn't like the hashkafa of the attendants." It's hilarious. "Oh, I'm not going. I don't agree. I would never step foot in there." The answer is, you don't see Torah as your lifeline. You'd see dialysis as your lifeline, Torah. You know, I can get by with but you can't get by. You can't get by. So, no one owns Torah. Don't let anyone make you feel like they own it. Sometimes you feel like, oh, you know, how can I learn Torah? I'm dressed a certain way. As someone who entered many, many Batei Medrash in this world, dressed more or less the way, not even dressed the way I am today for Rosh Chodesh, but in a blue shirt, I sat in many, many Batei Medrash. And I could tell you, as long as you don't walk in there prancing around trying to shove everyone off, no one's going to say a word to you. You can sit down dressed as you are now. You open up a few svarim and learn. Everyone will be happy for you to sit there, happy to show you what's going on. Oh, here's a YU guy, here's a Gush guy, here's a Ezra guy, here's a B'nai Akiva guy. Let's go to war. The days of ideological wars are long over. I can promise you, if any of you went to the mirror right now, and you sat down and opened a sefer, no one would say a word. No one would say a word. So the person who's kicking you out is yourself. You're giving yourself the boot. And Parshas Chukah says, don't give yourself the boot. There are many ways to learn Torah, known as a monopoly. You sit and learn. Another thing is one derech. The same token, a lot of Gush guys walk out and, you know, they think that there's only one derech. The guys in the Gush might be like, Chas v'shalom. It's not even a moral crime. It's just being an idiot beggar. I'm saying it's such harsh language. Not a moral crime. It's just asinine. It's just, I'm not angry at such behavior. I laugh at such behavior. Because it's so ridiculous. And a smidgen of maturity and a vision. I know it's hard not to have the same feeling of embrace and rebellion that you can talk about everything and identify with everything. And some of you can remember from high school having that dissonance and partial interaction. Okay, so you make your choice. I know many, many good yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael, not just Gush. If you're not happy with the dinners in Gush, I can send you many other heads to yeshivas. Not the dinners are better, but whatever. Send you to other places as well. And they're harder to find, has their like equations in Chutzlitz. It's a definition. But you have to decide right now. Are you going to be a man about it? And be colorblind and say, I don't care whether he's wearing a hat or a kippah suga or this or that, or he's Lubavitch or Satmar or Charedish or Yeshivish or this bish or that ish. I want Tanya Shemayim and I'm going to find it as best as I can. Are you going to say, I'm going to wait and wait and wait until I find the exact perfect Rebbe? I promise you, you'll wake up in probably a couple dozen years and realize how foolish you were, how foolish you were. Don't be an idiot beggar. Let's stop it. Thank you.